Did I tell you where Mary and I had our first date? We had a date for tennis. And we went out and played tennis. She neglected to tell me she'd never played before. And what was the statement you made about you didn't have to tell? I just asked what?
He didn't ask if I could play tennis. He asked if I wanted to play tennis.
So I spend most of the time over the fence, but I like this one. This, I take it, is your first time out for tennis. And then Mary and I do get along very well. We're planning a second honeymoon, if I can get an hour off work. But this really is characteristic of me. What would be a good day for you to clean the attic? Put down November 17th, 1994 probably. I should have put up on. I just grabbed that out of a file. I read a little story. Just a moment here. Make sure I get organized here. I read a little story about a mother and a daughter who were having a conversation, and they were having conflict. And the mother says, you know, I don't understand it. We used to get along so well together. We used to talk. We used to have hours of time together. And now all we do is argue with one another. The daughter said, boy, Mom, you're right. Why'd you change so much? And, you know, that is a perspective. The thing is that is what is often thought. Tonight, what we would like to do is we would like to share, it's really a seminar rather than a message that we'd like to share with you. And it's a seminar on when your kids aren't kids anymore, and maybe you aren't either. This is based on a book which I just totally misplaced. Oh, there you are. The book that Mary and I, that's why I need her up here. A book that Mary and I did a couple, 3 years ago, and it's available down in the bookstore if you want some details on some issues that we'll talk about. But we normally would take about 3 hours to do an introductory seminar on this. So that gives you a little idea of what we're going to try and do this evening, which is to take just some small parts, but to give you a little idea. Now, there are two approaches to this. First of all, there's a saying that says, once a parent, always a parent. You know, when your kids grew up and left home, you thought they were gone. Then why do you still worry so much? Why are they still on your mind? Why are your phone bills so big? And why do they keep coming back when you don't expect them? They come back from college. They come back from marriages through divorces. They come back from their job. They come back when they're out of money. And it's great to have them back. But it's also very confusing, both to you and to them. And then there's another little saying, once a child, always a child. Have you ever noticed, many of you who are in your 30s and even 40s, when you go back home, there are certain aspects of you that revert? You start relating, especially I think in the first 10 years of your marriage. You go back home and all of a sudden you become your parents' child again. And in fact, your parents treat you as though you hadn't gotten married. And that also is very, very, very confusing. In fact, there can be a lot of problems that come out of being the child, an adult child of parents. Because often parents will try and control, to manipulate, and to influence in a way that probably they ought not to do. And I think that Mary has a comment from a very famous philosopher.
Yes, Irma Bombeck, that great American theologian. But she has a way of stating things that I think hit the nail on the head. She says, if it's true that life begins when the kids are grown and the dog dies, then why do parents have all that wisdom left over? We feel compelled to pack our children full of every bit of sage advice handed down from our parents, plus all the omnipotence that we have assembled on our own. And parents become upset when their children leave because they go from being a supervisor to being a spectator of that child's life. It's sort of like being vice president of the United States. We have so much we want to tell them before they leave. We want to share that the number of checks in the checkbook doesn't always coincide with the amount of money left in the bank. And we want to tell them that federal taxes really aren't a personal option for them. The empty nest really hits us hard. Once we were the center stage in their lives, and now we look out and the audience has left the theater and they didn't even turn out the lights when they left.
One of the things that we feel need to be done and thought about in terms of parenting adult children is that we need to let go. And that is hard to do. It's hard to let go. You do it physically sometimes, but they still come back for money. They do it emotionally, and there's still a connect. And for those who leave home, they need to really leave. And if our observations are at all correct about what we see happening in many, many homes, is it's getting tougher to let go, and it's getting tougher to leave, particularly in some of the difficult economic times that we're involved in. Ann Landers made a little statement, another great theologian of our time. She said, never has a group tried so hard and been blamed so much as today's parents. Because when we were growing up, it was the sort of the thing that if you blew it, people said, shape up, you naughty kid. Why don't you get on with it and blame you? Today, kids grow up, and if they do wrong, they say, well, it's your parents' fault. And that is what is happening in psychology if you read a lot of the books that are being written today. Now, we'd like to talk about two periods of time in two groupings. One is what we call the volatile years of about ages 16 through 22. And this is when a person is a child, a teen, an adult, and you never know which. They can flip in 1 second, in 10 minutes. And at one point they can be a child, the next a teen, and the next an adult. And then we will talk about the very independent, anxious ages of about 22 and up, but primarily about 22 to 30. And when people are having all those new experiences, they're graduating from college, they're getting a job, they're getting married, they're having their first child, they may be buying a house, all of those things are coming into their lives. And where are the parents during this time? The parents are worrying, being anxious, wondering why Proverbs 16:22 does not work. Or Proverbs 22:6, rather, doesn't work. Train up a child, in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Because we see them making choices that we wish they were not making. Now, we'd like to address a couple things. One is, how can you prepare for this time, and how can you get through this time? If you don't have adult children, and I know many of you are here who do not, you can both think ahead, but also think of your own relationship with your parents right now. And the other thing is, it's very helpful to look at your own personal background and try and figure out who you are in relationship to your parents, even though they may be dead and gone. And then look at your parents as to how you related to them. I think we would also say that all of us need to admit our own personal need to change and grow. Now, we've already written it out on the outline, but let me just review with you what our goal is. Our goal for our sons and daughters is that they grow into mature, independent, godly adults who base their lives on sound principles, who are emotionally and spiritually strong, who have a strong sense of responsibility toward their fellow man, who will face good and difficult times with calmness and perseverance, and who, if married, become competent and faithful husbands, wives, and parents.
There's a verse in Scripture which I think is encouraging as our children grow and begin to assert their own independence. And it's Isaiah 1:2, and it says, it's God speaking, and he says, I have reared children and brought them up, and they have rebelled against me. So even the perfect father had rebellious children, and none of us are going to be perfect parents. And as you see those little ones begin to express rebellion, independence, negative traits, and then if that continues into their adult lives, just remember that God identifies with our hearts in that regard, because he, the perfect father, had rebellious children. There's some interesting suggestions in Scripture for family relationships between parents and children. We're all familiar with children, obey your parents. And that covers the parental and child responsibility when that child is still in the home. There needs to be authority and there needs to be obedience. But then there's a command that covers everybody, no matter how old we are, and that's honor your father and mother. God deemed that very important. It doesn't matter if you are 70 years old sitting here. God has commanded that we all honor our parents. And this can take various forms. Someone said to me one time, if you can't honor your parents for anything else, you can honor them because God chose them to give you life. And many of our parents probably aren't worthy of a lot of honor or respect. They've done things in their lives or made choices that are definitely anti-God, and they may have hurt us in many ways, but nevertheless, the Scripture tells us to honor our father and our mother.
I just read yesterday in a study, or not a study, but a comment by a greeting card company. And they decided to help people out in prison. And one thing they decided to do was to make greeting cards available to all the inmates for Mother's Day. And so they went in and they set up a room, and all they had to do was to come to that room, get a card, fill it out, and they'd take care of it and mail it for them. And they were swamped. And they said, this is a great idea. Let's do it also for Father's Day. And they set up the same room for Father's Day, and not one inmate appeared. True story. I just got it yesterday. And that shows you what is happening in our society. People are growing up fatherless and have great resentments toward their fathers. I'd like to talk a little about the ages and stages of parenting. Do you want to do that?
Go ahead.
The ages and stages of parenting. Now, I mentioned that letting go was important, but letting go is not dropping our children from a 10-story building or shoving them out into the cold with no coat, but it's rather a gradual release and ever-increasing freedom. But the problem is timing. It's how to do it when. And that's what this illustration is meant to be, the one that's down in the lower right-hand corner. Now, you can get it very quickly as you see it. You begin with control. You have absolute control over the lives. You change their diapers, you feed them, you put them to bed, you dress them. You do everything for them when they're children. And then as they gradually get older, you start decreasing the control tremendously. Then you move into a stage of coaching. Now, you think of the concept of a coach. A coach on a football team does run the team, but he doesn't run the plays. But if that player is out there and they don't do it right, they jerk them out of the game and have a little word with them, and then they send them back in. But no matter what, the coach is still on the sideline, perhaps even sending in plays, but that kid is out there doing the playing. That's what coaching is, and we need to transition very quickly to coaching. Everybody sees it with little kids. you know, that are just learning to walk, or they're learning to put blocks together, or our grandchildren now have these little letters, you know, that you put into puzzles, and they have these blocks that go in certain sizes of holes, you know, that's triangles and circles and squares, and you can't do it for them, and they try it and they work at it. No, you put that one over there. No, you do that. See, that's coaching. And we all love to do it with little kids, but it's harder to do with kids as they get older. And that coaching goes on probably a little bit, certainly into the teens, but I believe also decreases quickly. Then you get into the stage of counseling. And counseling is when they ask you what you think, but you aren't coaching and you aren't controlling. And of course, throughout this whole thing, caring and loving is a very, very important aspect of our lives. Now, one of our problems is that we tend to do all of these too long. I don't know a parent, hardly, who doesn't try to extend the control phase too long, and who doesn't do the coaching too long, and then walks in with counsel when you're not asked. One thing we have discovered is you don't just give counsel, but you give counsel when it's asked, but all the time you love and encourage them.
One of the stages, and many of you may be in this right now, is parenting adolescents. And it's a very uncertain time for them and for the parents. There are two obsessions that adolescents have, and that is how they look and how they feel. And our society reinforces these attitudes, probably much more than most places in the world, except perhaps Western Europe. So if you're in this stage or you're approaching, if you can gear into the mindset of your son or daughter coming and help them through it, trying to devise ways to get them to focus out beyond that, to have a spiritual focus, as well as the fact that they will be concentrating here, and that's what their peer group will be doing as well.
Do you want to go ahead and do the boomers now?
Yeah, we can. Jerry and I, since we actually wrote this book, have done a little study in the area of generational differences. And a lot is being done, a study here, and especially in the Christian field, because it makes a difference in the way we reach out and touch the lives of unbelievers for Christ, and also how we minister to people who have already come to Christ. There are basically three areas now of generations. There's the establishment. Anybody 45 and above is establishment. Then the baby boomers, which is probably the most familiar term, range from about 27 to about 45, and the baby busters are 25, 26, and on down. And now sociologists are beginning to talk about the baby boomlet, which would be, say, under 17. Very important in the economics of our country and the politics and so on. You'll be hearing about it a lot as we approach the election. Now, you can see from this graph that the baby boomers have the advantage. So if you're between 26 and 45, you are a very influential group because there are so many. The establishment took a real dip just before the boomer boom began. And then there has been quite a dip in the buster generation. And some of you may have seen elementary schools closing in your neighborhoods and so on. That's the big dip in the buster generation. The boomlet is beginning an increase again. Just a few ideas of how strongly the influence of these three generations is. Right now, the establishment controls a great deal of the economy of the country. But the boomers, because of the size of their group, can control the politics in the country. 85% of the people who work in media, either television, newspapers, whatever, are boomers. And so the philosophy of life coming through the media comes from the boomer generation. The buster generation feels disenfranchised, angry, resentful, especially toward the boomers for using up the good jobs, wrecking the environment, and feeling that they will then have to support this generation on into their old age. Since we've gotten to know a little bit about this, we've tried to pick it up as we're sharing with people and talking in different arenas of life. And it's really pretty distinctive. Even as believers, as we blend and fellowship together and notice it less, still the people with whom you relate in our society as a whole think like these different groups. For example, establishment are called the Us Generation. They went through depression, they went through the Second World War. If they didn't all draw together as a group, they were lost. The boomers were the me generation. There were so many that they had to scramble and fight for the good jobs, for their place in the society. And the buster generation is we, just this little group, and we're having to fend off the boomers and the establishment. And if you listen to the music that your children listen to, if you pick up some of their magazines and so on, this will come through. The establishment had societal absolutes. People behaved in a certain way because society as a whole was kind of watching out. Doesn't mean that sin was any less or that they were a more righteous generation. Not so. But there were certain societal parameters. The boomers had personal absolutes, and the busters basically have no absolutes. They may find some as they come along, but right now it's whatever goes, whatever makes me feel good. Why don't you move it up, honey, a little higher? Like, yeah. Establishment, you can probably see this real easily. Conservative, radical, and pragmatic, which is one way the busters are looking for their place in the whole society. And then this, I think, is really interesting, and it impacts us as we talk with our kids, with their friends, with unbelievers. I think this is really a key one that Jerry and I have found. The establishment generation went for tact. You might be thinking it, but you wouldn't necessarily say it, or you'd couch it in really polite terms. The boomer generation is very candid. You remember that expression, let it all hang out, you know, just say whatever's on your mind. The busters are openly honest, but there isn't as much opportunity for dialogue. They'll say what they're thinking, but they don't really want to listen necessarily to anyone else. That's important when you're sharing Christ, that we come from the right approach. Survival mentality, competitive, and entitlement mentality. Some of you may have kids in college, say that age, and they feel like you need to pay all the bills. I was driving with my daughter one day in her college town, and the bumper sticker on this little sports car in front said, I love daddy's money. Well, that's kind of the attitude of the buster generation, and our society has fostered that. The handouts from the government, mom and dad were making good money, and it just flowed freely. It's very difficult to adjust then back to poverty level, which some of them have to do when they strike out on their own. Oh, you went ahead of me. And the last, you can see community-oriented, need, and world-oriented. We don't want to belabor this too much, but just as you're thinking of relating to your parents, to your teens coming up, some of this information is helpful. Even though your own thinking blends pretty well, these are the peer groups that they're living in. These are the people that they're relating to. Yeah.
Yeah, we can right. Make that available.
Yeah, we'll have it tomorrow night.
One thing you might notice is that if the churches like the Willow Creeks, Saddleback Community, others like this, they are building their entire program around those two, what some people call paradigms or ways of thinking. In other words, instead of having the young couples group, you'll have the divorced parents group, or you'll have the recovering alcoholics group, or you'll have the parents of teens group, which is what I teach at our, Mary and I work with at our church. They are need oriented. People respond to needs, not to doctrine, not to loyalty. And one thing you'll find out here is the establishment was loyal to institutions. Boomers were not necessarily disloyal, but they distrusted institutions, and to the busters, they don't matter in the slightest. And they have no denominational loyalty and generally no particular doctrinal loyalty. Now you say, well, that helps us know. Did you want to do that one?
Better not take time.
What is it that we would like to help our children become? Now, I gave you a goal, but I would like to simplify that even to two other goals. And these I would call signs of maturity. You say, now, what is maturity? Have you ever tried to define it? You know, you can find people 60 years old who still act and think like kids. You can find people in their 40s who have never put life together. And here are two things that I believe are key issues. If I had to narrow this down to two things that I would want to communicate to my kids, not necessarily spiritual issues, but just two lifestyle thinking means. One is that they would predict and understand the future consequences of present decisions. Has it ever frustrated you that when you're talking to a child who says they're going to do thus and so and they're 19 years old, and they just don't think about what this will mean in the future? And the second thing is to learn to sacrifice present pleasure for future fulfillment. Those are two of the most difficult concepts to communicate to our children as they grow up. But I believe they're two of the most important. Now, I wouldn't say they are the most important, because it is very likely that there are other things that ought to also be shared with them. Now, one of the things that we would really like to do with our children, I'll leave that up for just a moment or two, is we would like them to grow to real independence. There are three kinds of independence that we want our children to gather or to perform. One, we want them to have spiritual independence. Secondly, we would like them to have physical independence. That is, they can support themselves. And thirdly, we would like them to have emotional independence, to be somehow separated emotionally from our home. That doesn't mean they don't love you, they don't want to come back, but they need to establish their own circles. Now, I'd like to just mention a few things on the matter of spiritual independence. And we're going to do that in a little bit.
Okay.
We'll hold on to that.
Okay.
On the spiritual independence. First of all, I believe that children and young adults choose for themselves. And they've got to. You've got to let them choose. And it may hurt you greatly. Some will choose to heartache and to disaster in their own lives. And we've all seen it. And some will choose to deep spiritual convictions. We've got a little session that we have done for our Sunday school class, this Parents of Teens class. And I'll tell you, you want to sit in on an honest class. I mean, they do let it all hang out. They may be establishment, but let me tell you, there is where the cover comes down. And they are opening up their hearts and their lives. We did a little session on questions teens are thinking but are always afraid to ask. And they're things that have doubts like, does God exist? But they often don't ask you. You know, is Christ really the only way? Is the Bible really true? What about all this business of science? Now, you know the arguments. You've heard them from other college students. But when the kids are 12, 13, 14, and 15, believe me, they are thinking about those issues. I'll bet you did. And I'll bet you did as you grew up. So what are the keys to spiritual independence? Well, one of the things is that there is a certain process through which they will each go on any particular issue. The first is what I call recognition. They recognize there's a problem. I don't believe Christ is the only way. After all, there are other good people in the world. The second thing is they may go through a period of rejection of their parents' beliefs and their values. And you see them wrestling with that all the time. Thirdly, they will come to a time of re-evaluation. And finally, there will come to either a rekindling or an alteration. Now, this may take years. They may be 45 years old before they come back to a full belief in the Lord, if they've wandered away. And they may alter the beliefs. I know our kids are growing up not believing exactly as we do. And it's kind of hard, because you watch them making choices, and most of them are good choices. But it still is hard. Now, what is it that we want in terms of spiritual independence? One thing I believe that we want is that they have beliefs that are truly their own. One of the things that leads to deadness in a body of Christ is second-generation Christians. It says, God has no grandchildren. You've heard that phrase before. There are only sons and daughters. The second is for them to understand that the Bible is the source, then to teach them to search for themselves. And if I had one spiritual habit I would try and communicate to young people and young adults is to get daily time with God. I would not abandon the quiet time. No matter what you're wrestling with, take time daily to read the Word and to pray. And then I would encourage them to seek fellowship, to be involved with other believers. And finally, that they would really pray for guidance.
One reason that it's really important to let these things surface, these honest, searching questions, when young people are in their teens and still in our homes, is that if those questions aren't answered then, they may abandon the faith. 50% of high school seniors in evangelical churches in the next 2 years will abandon the church and they will never return. 50% will remain in the church. That's too high a statistic. They need to be able to, with their parents, surface these things, talk them over, and realize that these are credible questions and there are realistic answers from the Word.
One last thing in this area that I'd like to mention, the how of spiritual independence, that we want them to have roots and not ruts. We don't want them to do it just because we did it. Yeah, it makes us more comfortable, but it may not be theirs. The second thing is they need, and this is a key thing to pray for in our kids' lives, pray that there will be significant others in their lives. Because by the time they're 16 years old, sometimes 15, sometimes 14, you are basically not the main influence in their lives anymore, and what's more, never will be again. They will get their clues from other people, and pray that God will bring into their lives the right people to influence them. I think we need to avoid stifling legalism and then learn to discuss the issues with them. We need to be able to interact with them, and believe me, it is very, very hard to do that. Why don't you
put this?
Well, let me see. We gotta. Okay, I did not put this on this particular handout. I just made a brief handout for you. But I think we'd like to. I think we've got time, honey, to talk a little about the decision-making process.
Okay.
Let's do it because I think it's interesting. Sorry about that.
We're on track now.
We're on track, back on track here again. First of all, one of the things that we really want to help our kids do and we would like them to do well is to make good decisions. Does it ever frustrate you that your kids don't make good decisions according to your standards? Well, I'm going to share with you a couple items of the decision-making process that they go through. And you have the question, what determines how in a young adult makes decisions? Well, here are several things that we have found. This is not exhaustive, but it's something that will help us, I think. One is the parents' example. We grow up hating the way our parents made decisions and then do them the same way. It's amazing how we think like they think. The second, it depends greatly on their personality and their intellectual ability. Thirdly, it depends on how they think, and Mary in a moment is going to share something on that. Fourthly, it depends on how spiritually vital they are. Fifthly, it depends on their education and training. People who have gone to university do think and make decisions differently, usually, than people who haven't, in the kind of environment they've been in. And lastly, it's the peer influence. Now, I put asterisks by three of those. What do you think the asterisks are there for? What's that?
Emphasis.
Well, it's emphasis, but it's something else, too. Right, that's exactly right. The ones with the asterisk are the only ones that we can influence. You can only influence your example, the spiritual areas, and helping them in their education and training. The others, you have virtually no control over. And I think you'll enjoy what Mary has to share on the whole idea of styles of thinking. And some of you have thought of this before.
This is highly simplified, and you can go into books and read it in a lot of detail, but just for illustrative purposes, when you, as a husband and wife, start to talk over decisions or attitudes and so on, do you often notice how you come from a different point of view and how it's hard to get the other one to gear in with the way you're thinking? Well, then you throw in three or four kids with that mom and dad that haven't quite gotten it together, and it can be very complicated in a family. How do you do this thing, honey? For example, there are the analytical thinkers. They can take information from all areas and look at it all and come up with a conclusion. This is how Jerry thinks. This is how I think Jerry thinks. And I think it's probably God-given because it serves him well in the task that God's given him to do. Then you have intuitive thinkers. We have one of these in our family, sort of seat of the pants, off the cuff, just whatever comes to mind first. Now, this isn't bad necessarily, but it can be very frustrating to, say, an analytical thinker. And we have to have some point of understanding that these are ways of thinking, and they're not good and they're not bad. Then we have creative thinkers. These are the people who have 100 ideas for every one idea that comes into fruition. And if you have a toddler that's a creative thinker, it can run you into the ground in a week because they have all these ideas. However, they're not necessarily frustrated if the ideas don't amount to anything because they have plenty more where that one came from. So some of you may have a thinker like that in your family. Then we have logical thinkers, more plodding type of people, and I might be categorized this way. There are steps from 1 to 10, but if you lose steps 3, 4, and 5, you're sort of off kilter and you don't quite know where the thing is going. And so do you see what it would be like in our home to have an analytical, a logical, and an intuitive thinker, all trying to blend, come to understanding, and consensus? Visionary thinkers, probably Bill Bright, you know, 200 million Bibles around the world in 6 months' time or whatever, you know, just wonderful ideas. very visionary, and someone who's a visionary thinker can leave a logical thinker in the dust. So as you think of your own children and just how they approach life and how they're developing in this area and how you can gain understanding in your own family, this might be a little helpful. And as I say, it's highly oversimplified, but it does give an idea of one of the complexities in your in family life.
You look a little sleepy, so we're going to take a poll. How many are analytical thinkers? Can I see your hands? Okay. How many of you are intuitive thinkers? Okay. How many of you are creative thinkers? Okay. How many of you are logical thinkers? You want them 1, 2, 3, 4?
We've got them outnumbered, folks.
Yeah. How many are visionary thinkers? Okay. Now, how many of you, as a couple, are the same style of thinking? That's expected. You know, you tend to be attracted to your opposites in many ways. And, of course, we all contribute. Now, what do you do when you train and coach these young adults in their decision-making process? I think the first thing is to help yourself understand how you think. The second thing is help them see their thinking pattern and put the two together. Involve them in decisions as you're going through it so you can train them in doing it. Let them fail. They must make decisions and live with their consequences. And then finally, help them to discern the long and the short-term effects of the decisions that they make. Do you have something? Okay.
I see a lot of yawns and drooping lids. Why don't you stand up and sit down? And then we'll try
not
to...
Not at once. Just stand up for a second. Yeah, just stand up and take a little stretch break.
And then we'll clip right along to the end.
We'll try and leave a few minutes right at the end also for some questions.
Okay, have a seat.
Okay, that was a quick break. Are you going to do family complexity?
I can. Are we moving on here?
Yeah, I'm going to do difficult times.
Okay, I'm going to sit down.
Okay.
And then if we don't have time, just don't
right.
do family complexity.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay, Mary says she wants to sit down because I've got the last section here. Okay, I'd like to discuss just a little bit with you on what to do when you face difficult times, the whole idea of facing the difficult times in our lives, and our kids are facing times like that. First of all, there are the problems that are not under their control. There are problems like divorce, which may not be under their control at some times, illness, accidents, loss of job, and so forth. There are a lot of problems that our kids have and will face that really they have no control over them. So what do you do when they face these difficult times? Here are some suggestions. Marshal prayer for them. I think at that time you do want to help them. You want to maybe make a loan to them. You want to bring them into their lives. You want to network finding help. I have found out that I know a lot of people around the world. And so I am almost always able to point them into some direction for some help that they may need in certain difficult times. Give financial help and counsel if they need it, and help them to think through the issues. And there are lots of things that could come up in this regard, and you can be of help to them. Now, what about the problems that they create? Now, this is a much more difficult area. The problems that they create. For instance, their marriage starts falling apart and it's their fault. They get on drugs or become an alcoholic. Or they have a pregnancy out of wedlock. Or they're in rebellion. Or they have an emotional collapse that is largely their own fault. What about homosexuality or promiscuity or suicidal tendencies? You can just go through the list. All kinds of things that are problems that really, as you look at it, they create for themselves. They have made decisions that lead them down the wrong path in their life. Now what do you do? I think one of the first things you do is they have to live with the consequences. You cannot always be the rescuer. I was talking with some person, I won't even identify a city or anywhere else, who had a child who is a prostitute on the streets of New York today. I mean, and when I've given this seminar, Mary and I have in various contexts, we have never failed to have somebody who has something like that. Their children are just going off the deep end and they cannot do anything about it. The second thing is you need to wait with patience, because there is very little in many of these cases that you can really do. The third thing, do everything you can to keep the communication open. You may not provide money, you may not go to rescue, but you can keep the communication open. The third thing is to pray. This is when prayer is so needed in our lives. And the final thing is, many times it will take a third party to help them. You will not be able to help them. Now, this is the problem. These are the problems that you feel the most desperate over, because there is so little that you can do. On the other ones, you can get in there and work, and you can help, and you can rescue, and you can do things. But here, there is very little that you can do. The problem is that most of us as parents want to go fix it, and we can't. Now, what about yourself during these difficult times? What do you do? First of all, let me really encourage you that when your kids are going through difficult times, to keep in fellowship with God. You can't help them unless you have vitality. Secondly, is to guard your health, because this is a time when you can really go downhill. And this is just the time of life. When your kids are young adults, when you're getting into your 50s and your 60s, and when your health could go very, very quickly. And the last thing is, have a group to pray and share with. You need a support group. Mary mentioned to you this little group that she has gone to, which I have not, called Parents of Murdered Children. Now, many of us need people who are going through difficult times also to really empathize with. And those who have not gone through it have a very difficult time in relating to what you are personally going through in your own life. Now, I'd like to just make a few comments, and then I'm just going to stop and to give some time for questions. I think all of us, as we look back on our parenting time, feel that we've made mistakes. And by the way, all of you who have younger kids, I guarantee you, you will make mistakes. And there are many times cleavages that have taken place in the relationships between you and your children. And I think it is very important for us to think about healing the past, going back and making sure that we heal the past. I think we'll skip that family complexity, honey. We have a little chart that just shows how incredibly complex families get, as you have in-laws and kids and grandchildren and all of that. But many times in the healing process, you have to go through a time of recognition. There are no perfect parents. And I would just suggest that if you have some problems with your kids, that you write down three or four of the mistakes that you may have made, and you go and confess it to them. That would be a first step in a healing process. Because there is healing then of forgiveness. And you need to forgive them, and they need to forgive you. And then I believe we need to protect the future by healing the past and learning from the past. Now, as Mary and I have thought a great deal about this particular area, we realize that parenting adult children is difficult because you really have a difficult time learning what your limits actually are. And I believe that children at all ages are the greatest emotional drain that a person can have. How many of you people, I see a few gray-haired folks, have found this to be true? Can I see your hand? You know, it's pretty hard, isn't it? I mean, you want to get in there and fix it. But about all you can do at times is to pray. Because many of you have children who are not walking with God. You have children who are doing things that you would prefer that they wouldn't do. You probably have some children who are raising their kids, not even teaching them anything about the Lord. And you as the grandparent are the only connect. But folks, this is real life. And these children are a trust. They're a legacy. And they're an investment. And the one phrase that Mary and I would share with you as we close and open to some questions is the last chapter is not written yet. And it may not be written till after you're gone, but God is still going to work in your kids' lives. So let's just stop and we will just have a little time of questions. We'll just take a few minutes, and there may be some things you'd like to discuss. What we've tried to do is give you some highlights of this particular topic. Yes.
Is most of what you have put up and discussed in your book?
All except the boomer material is in the book. Well, we moved awfully fast. But I think what we wanted to do is to sort of give you a picture of some of the issues. Because everybody is facing different things in their lives. Like I say, and maybe we shouldn't do this, but we've been asked to a number of times to condense what we would consider to be about a three-hour seminar where we really interact about every 10 minutes on a topic into a short period of time. That's what we've tried to do tonight. There was a question right there, yes.
We've got a 60-year-old.
Well, in every area that you can, you have to let go in the decisions where it is not going to be directly harmful to them. You may not let go of the car. You may not let go of all the money, but I think by age 16, they are basically going to make their own decisions. Now, a little difference between whether it's a guy or whether it's a gal. For instance, you discuss some of the issues of, by the way, as long as they're in your home, I believe there are certain rules that they do have to live by. But you cannot control how they think. You really can't control what they do except in certain limits. So just like a child learning to walk, you want them to fall, but you watch that they don't fall against something hot. Do you see what I mean? And that's where I would put the limit in that regard.
You mentioned something about perhaps an emotional collapse, and you said you put that under things that were their fault.
Sometimes.
Well,
I think you can tell what is happening. It may be by very, very bad choices that they have made. And there may be things that they've done. That's one that can go under either. Sometimes the emotional collapse is not at all of their own. It's not of their own making. But the other thing is they have made choices. And in that one, you can get in and work with them if they want your help.
You mean choices like, gross sin?
Yeah, choices like sin, their marriage choices, the way they live. For instance, drugs can lead to an emotional collapse. You know, those are so carefully connected. Now, you may have to get in and help the rescue, and I know people who do, but you have to be very careful because, in all likelihood, you cannot be a crutch for them.
You have a slide on maturity.
Yes.
It seems to me that the opposite of that is what's called emotional problems. What are your suggestions of early leadership that can be done to promote maturity in children?
Well, the two things that I mentioned on maturity was to predict future consequences of present decisions, and the second one was to sacrifice present pleasure for future benefit. And I think if you start in small things and start saying those things, helping them to see the future and letting them fail in the small ways. But see, our tendency when they're very young is to rescue. You know, they get their allowance and they spend it all on candy, and we still supply something more for whatever. We give them a birthday present of the things that they were spending the allowance for. We tend not to allow them to live with the consequences of their decisions because we love them and we want to be merciful. But somehow we've got to allow them to experience those things early. Now, this is harder for the baby busters. And I didn't read the quotes, but Susan Litwin, in a book called The Postponed Generation, says that those in the baby buster age have grown up with a sense of expectation. They almost don't want to get married because why leave home when they can have a swimming pool and two cars and a nice place to live and go live in some crummy apartment which they can afford? But they expect to have what their parents had now and without working for it. That's a general pattern of thinking. And if you watch their buying patterns, there's a lot of analysis been done on this, you'll find that. Yes.
Daughter is 12, the one who's 16. She wants to date. Her friends are dating. We told her not until she's 16. But that's what we're probably going to have to do in a little. But do you guys suggest?
Well, the suggestion is you need to follow your convictions before God, explain them to her. We personally did not allow our daughters to date until they were 16 alone. We had them do a lot of group activities and really encourage them in being in group activities. But the individual dating, we also had a little thing that I interviewed the guy between 16 and 18 before they dated, and not the night of the date, which is kind of an interesting process in our home. I don't know whether I could. You should have seen the other girls when I was doing the interviews. I have had some scared guys in my house. And then they kept confronting and said, would you have done that with Steve? And that was a hard question because, frankly, our son Steve did not date until he was about 18. And so we didn't really run into it. But we talked about this for years. This was not something that we sprung on them at age 16. And we also talked about the dating situation. I don't think there's any rule in the Bible. And there's not some big thing that I can tell you what to do. That's why I think you need to chat with other parents as to what they're doing, what they're learning, and what their situation is. And that's just an issue of control at that point.
Anybody wants to chat for a
scene here? Yeah, you'd love to talk, wouldn't you? Well, it's amazing how talkative you get. Yes, and then there was someone right over here. Yes.
Turning it around a little bit, how about how does the adult child handle or deal with the over-controlling parent?
Yeah, that is a very key one. I did a radio talk show thing by phone and a call-in. It was down in Texas, as a matter of fact, where the show was coming from. And it was an hour long, and I expected to have all of these frazzled parents calling me. Over half of the calls were from young people of about age 27 to 35 sharing how they cannot get their parents to stop interfering in their lives and trying to control them and trying to manipulate them. And I think when that is going on, it may call for a confrontation and it may call for a distancing for a period of time. And it will cause some strain and some stress. And also, if it's the wife who's this, it's usually the wife's mother or parents who do more of the controlling than do the husband's, and that's where the husband needs to move in to protect his wife in that regard. It's tough, boy. I tell you, that is in-law stuff that won't quit. And sometimes many of us don't think we're controlling, but we are. By just our subtle suggestions. And the hardest word to say is nothing. Really tough. There was a question of yes.
Yeah, you mentioned that personality was one thing that parents could not influence. Is there a... I remember reading Dr. Meyer a long time ago saying that personality in children are fixed by the age of 6. Is there new thinking on that?
Well, I don't know what he means by fixed, but it may mean that some aspects of the personality. But I believe if you watch, we've been watching our little grandchildren. You know, when you're older, you sure watch a lot more carefully. And you watch their personalities, and they change very little. And their personalities are formed, certain aspect of it is just genetic. Now, I don't pretend to be a psychologist, and I just don't want to say I know the answers to this. You certainly can have great influences on the various styles of thinking and personality when they're growing up, because every personality has its downsides, and it has its positives. And so every one of us have a crummy side of us. And what you want to do is to try and keep that side from taking over as dominant, and the good parts of that personality from being emphasized. And that you can influence. But I have a question: if you can change the basic personality. I mean, you can't take a melancholic and make him a choleric. And you see that from the ground up in kids. You see it in yourself. I mean, you ask your parents, was I like this when I was five? And just exactly like that. They could tell it from the time you were growing up. Well, I think we ought to quit. It's 9 o'clock. You have to go retrieve your kids. So let's have a word of prayer. Father, thank you for this time. Help us to understand more what it means to be a parent, and then to be a parent of adult children. Help us to prepare for that time and to live in that time with grace that comes only from you. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.